Okay, good morning. So as we said last week, we're continuing on the general theme of trying to figure out what's going on in these missing years in the life of Moshe, in the life of Moses, focusing on, as we said, two gaps. One is simply the narrative gap. Right? What happened, right? We meet him when he's born. For the first 3 months of his life, he's taken in by the daughter of Pharaoh, and then we don't hear about him until he goes out to fight against the Egyptian to save the Jew who's being beaten. He flees to Midian. We hear that he gets married, and then the next thing we know, he's 80 years old, coming before Pharaoh. And right, there are a lot of years missing. Where exactly those years are missing is not clear. It depends on how old he is when he goes out the first time. Right, so that could be 20, that could be 40, all types of different possibilities. But there's that narrative gap. And in addition to the narrative gap, there is the identity question. Right, is in that question is who. Who is Moshe, right? Who does he identify with? What does he identify as in this period? At what point does he really become... No, the shoots are still here from last week. No. At what point does he really become identified? Does he himself identify as a Jew, an Egyptian, etc.? And we noted that there is an entire Midrashic... Yeah, this is last... there's an entire Midrashic tradition.
You want a mic?
Yeah.
You need a mic?
Should I try it?
Yeah, let's try
it. I don't need the mic, no. Just this. Try this.
Created 3,000 years ago.
No.
The five books.
Okay, we've survived. We'll have to survive. Okay. So we noted that there's really two Midrashic traditions in terms of the identity question. There is the tradition that Moshe was very much an Egyptian. And those are the traditions that criticize him, that when he goes to Midian, he's identified by the daughters of Yitro as the Egyptian man who saved us, and the Midrash criticizes Moshe for having been identified as an Egyptian rather than a Jew, contrasting him with Yosef, contrasting him with Joseph. The Midrash even claims that's why he doesn't get buried in Israel. Certain Midrashim go even farther and say even if it's not Egyptian per se, he was willing to give up one of his sons to idolatry, to Yitro. Again, sort of emphasizing the possibility that Moshe is not identified as a Jew from birth. Yeah.
But it says here that when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk.
Right, so that's the...
Correct.
Correct. So this sort of side of the equation is going to have to read that verse, his kinsfolk, as a description of reality rather than his perception, right? That he went out to the people who were in fact his kin, right? Even if he doesn't identify with them, right? That he, and then you would read that story we talked about this last week, as evidence of his compassion for humanity, less than his evidence of his identification with Jews, qua Jews. And then we noted that may be very much a Rebecca moment, right? The fact that he ends up sort of reliving that Rebecca moment at the well may be an indication that just like Rebecca wasn't born Jewish, but she had the ideals of Judaism, which is why she's brought into the family, Moses may have been like that early in his life, right? He's Jewish at heart, even if he doesn't yet identify with the people. And we noted that some of the movie clips really sort of play up on that theme from Gods and Kings, where God confronts Moses and says to him, right, you know, he says, you know, it's hard for me to watch this happen to the people I grew up with, and God says to him, again, leaving aside the anthropomorphic thing with God as a boy, but whatever, says to him, what about the people you didn't grow up with? You still don't think of them as yours, do you? That's sort of one tradition. And then there's the other tradition that in the Midrash, that he really was Jewish from the get-go. Right, that he was really Jewish from the get-go, you know, and he identified as such, even pushing it as far as his when he nursed And one of the Midrashim says the reason that he nursed, he refused to nurse from the Egyptians because he was going to speak with God, which already sort of pushes his Jewish identity back already towards the beginning. So that's where we had left off last week. But one of the things that I think is fascinating to imagine from this is the following question, right? I've been trying a lot with the movies to because movies are visualizations, it allows you to think, like, what does this look like? So one of the questions that I think we don't necessarily think about when we're at our Seder is how hard is it for Moshe to be the messenger of God to bring these plagues on Egypt? Right? Like, what are we imagining? Right? Are we imagining Moshe, you know, the more that you think he's Egyptian, the more he identifies that way, the more you can imagine that when he gets before Pharaoh, this is actually very hard for him. Right? Each time he does it, he's, you know, and you know, how do you imagine it? You know, we if you go through the stories in Tanakh, we have two very different models. We have stories where people are called upon to do things that they are totally on board with, and that they totally identify with God. You know, I don't know, Joshua going into the land of Israel, right? You don't get the feeling there's any resistance, right? He goes in, he wants to go in, he's ready. All the people who didn't want to go into Israel have died. It's just him, right? From the beginning, he was one of the two spies that stood up for God, that said, we can go to Israel, it's going to be great. And then 40 years later, he's appointed to be the leader, and he does it, and he takes them in, right? He's been waiting 40 years for this. Everyone else, he had to wait for everyone else to die out for a generation that shared his enthusiasm, but right, he's ready to do it. At the other extreme, you have moments like, I don't know, the Akedah, right? When Avram is called upon to sacrifice his son, and you just imagine a struggle, right, where, you know, he, even if he's ready to do it, it's hard. And that's exactly what God wants from him. God wants him to struggle with his loyalties. But if the Midrashic tradition that says that Moses, until this point, really still identifies as an Egyptian, is correct, then what must that have meant for him when he gets before Pharaoh? Hey, that's something I don't think we... And if it means that he's struggling, why did God want that? That's sort of a question I never really thought about before. Why would God want that? And, you know, here, let's to move to our first clip. This is from The Prince of Egypt. This is the animated one. And this is a song that Moses and Pharaoh both sing, right? It has both of them singing, called All I Ever Wanted, right? About how they grew up together. At the beginning of the movie, has them growing up as children together, as princes in the palace, and competing with each other, and playing, you know, their best of friends, brothers, etc. And now God has, you know, ordained it that it's brother against brother. And this is the song that they play. About to run away. Sorry, 1 second. This is a bit earlier than I remember. They repeat this song later on as an encore. But this is when he first finds out he's a Jew, right? And it shatters his identity, so he sings this song, right? All I Ever Wanted, if you're listening to the words, right? I'm a sovereign prince of Egypt, right? right? Right, so in here, they imagine, right, when he first finds out he's a Jew, right, he's broken, right? All he ever wanted was to be an Egyptian, right, a sovereign prince of Egypt, right? And then, right, as you can imagine, it will get hard when he actually gets to, I didn't actually put this clip here. Okay, I'll have to find it. When he actually gets to right before Pharaoh, he's going to be struggling against, you know, himself. And you know, I'll pull up this clip in a second. But the question I think we have to ask is why, right? Why would God want that, right? Why would God want a prince of Egypt, someone who grew up in the palace, to be his messenger? And you know, here I think, you know, we can sort of imagine many different things, but it forces us to think. You know, one thing I thought is perhaps it's because the Jews, for as much as we assume they wanted to go free, we know it's not true, right? We know that consistently they are always dreaming about Egypt, right? They always, throughout their complaints, it would be better to go back to Egypt. We remember the good food that was given to us, right? Meaning it isn't as black and white as the movies make it out. The Jews just want to get out of Egypt and they never want to turn back. They actually don't, right? They do want to be free. They're oppressed, but they actually identify with Egypt. And much of the story is about God getting them out of that mindset. If you look at the descriptions in Yeshayahu, it's clear, and we sort of mention this at the Seder, the Jews worship the same idols. Right? The act of the Karban Pesach, of the offering, is to force them to confront their own identity, right? Their own Egyptian identity versus Jewish identity, and kill the idol, the god of the Egyptians, and turn themselves into Jews. And it might be that the reason you have a leader who is so torn is because God, it's very easy to get someone who's totally on board with the mission if you have people who all are totally on board with the mission. But if you have a people who are struggling, and the story of the Exodus of Egypt is not as it's portrayed in the movies, of a people just ready to get out of the culture, get out of the country. Right? Remember, we saw the scene last week where when Moses comes to, in the Ten Commandments, Moses comes to his mother, right, to Yocheved, and he says, are you my mother? And she says, no, if you were a son of mine, right, you would be a slave, and you would believe in God, right? And anyone who believes that people should be enslaved and bows to idols of stone and wood is no son of mine. Right? There's a very idealistic vision of the Jews who, after 400 years, did not identify with the Egyptian culture at all, and they just wanted out on every level. But that's not the story the Torah tells us. The Torah tells us a story of people who were oppressed and wanted to get out of slavery, but were acculturated, right? The who needed to be prodded out of Egypt, right? Certain midrashim go farther and say that during Makar Choshech, during darkness, 80% of the Jewish people died, or 98%, or 99.8%. of the Jewish people died because they were the ones who didn't want to leave Egypt. And it was only the people who wanted to leave Egypt that God allowed out. And anyone else, God killed during the plague of darkness. Now, Midrashim often exaggerate numbers. But the point of the Midrash, right, that so many Jews died in darkness because they didn't want to leave, is that this sort of scene isn't just what's going on in Moshe's head, it's the Jews. And therefore, when you're at your Seder, you're not just telling the story of how a group of Jews who wanted to get out, God eventually said, it's time to go, but how God decided it's time for you to become Jewish. It wasn't just Moshe. It wasn't just Moses who was a prince of Egypt. It was the Jews who were Egyptian slaves. Right? They weren't just, right? They also have a torn identity. And that identity haunts them till the end of, right, the end of their lives. Right? This is why they don't make it into the land of Israel, because when push comes to shove, what they consistently say to Moses is, if only we had died in Egypt. Right? We remember the watermelon and the onions and the garlic and the fish that we ate in Egypt. Right? They idealize it because, you know, it's really hard. Even if you are oppressed, you're slaves, they still became part of the society. So I wonder, and you know, I didn't really think about it till now, but I wonder whether, you know, according to these midrashim, then imagine Moses as struggling with his identity if he's sent because he is symbolic of the struggle that the Jews are going through themselves, right? If you want to help the Jews out of that, what do? You don't send someone who's totally on board. You send someone who's consistently struggling with the same identity crisis, even more intensely than they are. Right? He's a prince of Egypt, and he is chosen. He's the one who has to go. He has to go to... that has to go to Pharaoh. Now this is the reprise of the song, right? Of that same song, right? The first one was him singing "All I Ever Wanted" when he finds out he's a Jew. So one second, let me just get this clip up, right? Wait, no. Yeah. So this is during the plagues, right? So this is skipping ahead. Right, so now the Egyptians are suffering. If you can hear the words, this is... Can you hear it? Those words, but you can see, even if you can't hear the words, so all you can see is face, right? The lines in the song, right? I used to call you brother, and even now I wish God had chose another, right? And you can see his face, right? It's the reprisal song, right? And now you get Pharaoh sings. This scene is actually quite masterful, I think, in capturing what might be going on, right? That if Moshe's identity is torn, so one aspect of it is he's struggling through the identity crisis that the Jews are. But there's other aspects to it, which is, right, what is, right, there's one line where Moses says, right, he says to his brother, right, he says to Pharaoh, says, how many innocents have to suffer, right? One of the themes that other midrashim play up on is that God wanted, even while we were being freed, wanted the Jews to recognize it was a human cost. Right? And you know, the Beit Yosef quotes the tradition that the reason that we don't say Hallel, except for the first day of Pesach, except for the first day of Passover, is because we're in mourning. Right? At some level, we diminish our own joy because the Egyptians were suffering. Right? Even though we're happy we're leaving, the Egyptians are suffering. But by sending Moses, what you see here is Moshe feels that in a visceral way, right? It's not just like theoretical, like feel for other human beings. If you send somebody who identifies with both sides, then you send someone who feels the human cost of doing, right? He may feel that it's necessary. It also, right, affects Pharaoh's psychology. If it's true, if it's his brother, it affects, right, it, as it does here, it creates the stubbornness. You know, when we ask, what does it mean that God hardened his heart? Well, this sort of this scene in the movie takes the position, how did God harden his heart? He sent Pharaoh's little brother, right, to lead the rebellion. And that's essentially what we're saying. If he grew up in the palace, right, this is the essentially sending someone's little brother to challenge their kingdom. You want to think of a naturalistic, psychological way of causing someone to harden their heart? Right? Send their little brother to come and try to one-up them. And I think we don't think through it enough. We don't imagine enough. If Moses grows up in the palace, himself identifies as the prince of Egypt, Ramses, probably Ramses II, identifies Moses as his younger brother, the drama of what's going on is so much more intense. I just, you know, until I sort of analyze the movies, you don't think, what does the whole scene look like? Right? The consequences of how we view the story are so much greater. We understand more what it means for the Jews and Moses to be struggling with their identity, that even after they're free, to still hang on to Egypt. We understand why you might want Moses, because if you watch your leader go through the process of identifying himself as a Jew, it helps you get through that process. It may not work, but you understand why you want to do it. It forces you to have someone there who will feel the human cost of the plagues, right? And therefore won't just want Pharaoh to give in for the sake of the Jews, but will want Pharaoh to give in for the sake of the Egyptians, for the sake of his own people. Right? And it creates a whole different psychological story, a whole different family drama for Pharaoh. Right? And, you know, this is where I said, you know, here we're, I'm, you know, speculating a lot more, but this is what Midrash is, right? Midrash is this, as we said last week, gap filling, is spelling out how, depending on how you fill out the gaps, what does the scene look like in your head? And when you take the Midrashic tradition that Moses identifies as an Egyptian until almost the end, you can't help but come to some sort of psychological complex like the movies portray, right? But we don't really imagine it because, right, we are just so used to Moshe being all in. But the truth is that if you really think he's the prince of Egypt, and that's who he identifies until God calls him, that adds so many levels. Now, again, these are all my speculations. These are my imaginations. But that's what Midrash is. Much of Midrash is trying to build the characters based on filling in the gaps. And it requires a bit of imagination. It requires a bit of engagement in the story. Yeah, in the back, yeah. No, 10 o'clock.
His
father's Amram.
Who was his mother?
No, so his mother is Yocheved. No, I don't mean he's actually Jewish. We know he's actually Jewish, right? The question the Midrashim struggle with is identity-wise, who is he? And you have one group of Midrashim that say he identifies as Egyptian, even though he is Jewish. Right, Midrashim that criticize him, that even when he gets to Midian, he's called the Egyptian, right? Because he still isn't identifying as Jewish. He's not identifiably Jewish, even if he's genetically Jewish. The Midrashim that go farther and suggest that when he goes to Yitro, Yitro makes a deal with him and says, your oldest child will worship idols and your second child will be for God. Right? The Midrash is trying to get you to realize he has a struggling identity. Now, there is the other Midrashic tradition, which you know, is the other way of imagining this, which is the opposite extreme, that from when he nursed, he only drank Jewish milk, right? That Midrash is clearly saying, no, 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 this whole thing is wrong. This is all wrong, right? Moshe may have grown up in the Egyptian palace, but he was Jewish from the start, right? That's what that Midrash is telling you. That even before he could talk, and all he could do was nurse, he would only nurse from a Jewish woman, because he knew, right, or God ordained, that he would be Jewish, right? And that Midrashic tradition is clearly going the opposite direction, saying, no, this is all wrong, right? The story of Moses is the story of someone who grows up in the palace and is always a misfit. He's always Jewish. He always knows who he is, right? And it's the coming back that we said last week, right? The hint, you know, the hush hush, wink wink, that you know Yocheved might have arranged for Moses to end up in the palace, and he's nursed by his mother for a few years, right? There's another way of imagining this whole story is that if everyone is in on it, then when he's being nursed by his mother and raised till he's 2, 3, 4, his mother tells him, you know, and you imagine this story more as like a, I don't know, you know, the stories in the Holocaust of people who were given to Christian families, but the Christian family was told by the Jewish parents, make sure my child grows up as Jewish, and despite the fact that it's countercultural, in secret, they raise their child as Jewish. Right, that's almost sort of what you would imagine. And that's a totally different way of imagining the story, right? That, no, he's Jewish, and then you understand, why is Moshe the iconoclast? Why is he willing to fight the Egyptian? Because he's the Jew growing up in the palace. He always knows he's different. That's, right, God literally raises him to be an iconoclast. Right, that's the sort of opposite extreme of what we're imagining, is that no, God wants him to be the Jew in the palace so that he'll know how to stand up to the Egyptians. Right? Those are two sort of, and again, like I said, this shear is much more speculation, but I think when you think about this question and that gap filling, you realize that what's at stake and how we fill the gaps are two totally different ways of imagining all these dramatic scenes that we have in our head. Right? When he says, let my people go, is that natural? And is it, he knew he was Jewish from the beginning, he's born to be an iconoclast, and he's just waiting for the moment to say to Pharaoh, let my people go? Or is, let my people go, part of Moshe becoming, identifying with that message, that these are my people and those are not? Right? Which story are we telling? And it's very hard to tell, but that drama is real. Right? And also ambiguous. And it's sort of telling that the Torah leaves it ambiguous. Maish, a question? Yeah.
So, isn't the Torah, as a form of literature, really, really clearly setting up a duality and a challenge with emotions, is that he's born and spends his first, whatever the number of years is, let's say 20 years or 10 years, to receive that basic Jewish, whatever that meant, being or history. But then he has to become the Prince of Egypt, because Israel has no idea how to have a leader.
Correct. And that's what Ibn Ezra says. Correct.
The last leader was Yosef.
Correct. And I think I mentioned this briefly last week, but part of the duality might be exactly what you're saying, and that's what Ibn Ezra says. The Ibn Ezra says, why does it all have to happen? Why does he have to grow up in the palace? Because you can't be a leader. He couldn't lead the Jews if he grew up amongst the Jews. It was only because he was an outsider with royal experience that he could come back and lead the Jews, right? Because, you know, he said, you can't be the rabbi in the shul you grew up in, right? They always view you as a kid, right? That's what it is, right? You can't, right? And Moshe isn't, right? And that's exactly what Ibn Ezra says. Yes, this is what he needs to be. He needs to grow up in the palace. He needs to grow up as an outsider. He needs to come in from the outside and be the headhunted superstar, right? That's exactly what he needs to be. He needs to be from the outside. And you're right. That's, you know, yeah, Morris.
Just reading the text of like when he snap at the burning bush. I mean, one of the first things God says to him, "Anachi alkei avicha, alkei avraham." So, I mean, Moshe obviously had enough basic Jewish, education.
I mean,
he didn't say, who are they? I mean, basically...
Right, so by this point, he clearly is aware of it, right? I mean, he clearly finds out he's Jewish at some point, right?
Some sort of basic Jewish
Well,
tradition or, you know.
So it's interesting you say that.
Even
because
though he's, it looks like he's almost like Esther, like he's an exterior, on the street. But interior, he has some sort of.
So that's really an interesting question, and I have a few clips on this. But that's really an interesting question, which is, yeah, when he meets God at the burning bush, God introduces himself as the God of your forefathers. But the question then becomes, okay, well, when did he find that out? Now, if you follow the Midrashic tradition that he knew he was a Jew from when he's born, so it's easy. But if he's an Egyptian, right, so then you got to ask the question, well, when did he find out? And for that reason, if you notice in each of the movies, right, there is a scene where he finds out. Right, we saw the one in the Ten Commandments last week where he finds, right, they have to imagine what happened, right? That the nursemaid actually, you know, held on to the cloak and gave it to, right, and gave it to Nefertiti, and Nefertiti let it slip, and then she, right, that's how he finds out, right? In the Prince of Egypt, right,
I'm sorry.
At some point he runs in, this is Miriam.
Oh, please forgive me, I didn't expect to see you here. Of all places, at our door. At last. Didn't I tell you, Aaron? I knew he would return to us when he was ready.
Miriam, you want to see him?
I knew you cared about our freedom.
Miriam, freedom? Why would I care about that?
Because you're our brother.
What?
They never told you?
Who knew?
See, right, the Prince of Egypt imagines it very differently, that he accidentally runs into Miriam and at some point and is told and is shocked. But why do all the movies, again, whenever the movies all try to come up with something, you realize there's a narrative gap. Right? And that's the narrative gap that Mars picks up on, is when did he find out he was a Jew and believed in, should believe in the God of our, you know, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? When did he get that? So each movie has to imagine their own way because the Torah doesn't tell you. Right, that's the point, is that the narrative gap that Chazal, the Midrashim, are picking up on is this gap. Is you have 80 years, you got to figure out when does all this happen? And the Torah leaves it purposely ambiguous because it leaves you to imagine different scenes, different possible scenarios. Now, I want to add a narrative component here. Another piece of this is what I gave you in 13. Right, is a very short unit, much later in the Torah, in Bamidbar. And this is Moshe's second wife. This is number 13 on last week's. I hope we'll get to the new sheet. But Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman he had married. He married a Cushite woman. Right. So later on in the Torah, we find out that there's this very ambiguous scene that Moshe marries a Cushite woman. Right? Isha Cushit Asher Lakach. And that's what we know. And Miriam and Aaron are not happy about it, and they speak badly about him, and God punishes them, and that's the story. And obviously, as we said, right, the goal of Midrash is to fill in narrative gaps. So suddenly, everyone said, okay, wait a second. Who is this woman that we speak of? And where does she come from? Right, where did a Cushite woman get to in the middle of the desert that he just married? So the Midrashim and the commentaries divide heavily. I didn't give you all the sources, but to give you a rundown. Many of the Midrashim, and Rashi follows this, they follow the traditional Midrashic approach. One Midrashic approach, which is sort of used in many Midrashim, is the conservation of biblical personalities. Right? Is that if we don't know somebody's name, we just identify them with somebody who we do know. So Rashi said, who's the Isha Cushit? Tzipora. Right? He doesn't have two wives, he has one wife. Why is she called Isha Cushit? So Rashi says, because she is as obviously beautiful as black is black. The Ibn Ezra just says, no, she's Middle Eastern, right? Cushit just means darker skinned, and right, she's not pale-faced because she's Middle Eastern. But whatever it is, they identify with her as Tzipora. And then they say, well, he was already married to Tzipora. Why are they complaining now? So they say, no, they're not complaining that he was married to Tzipora. They're complaining that he actually stopped living with her. Because at some point his prophecy was so consistent that he separated from his wife and they didn't understand why, and that's how the story ensues. That's one Midrashic tradition. There's another Midrashic tradition, which is found This is a story that floats around in different forms, in Josephus, in Philo, in a very odd, very long midrash called Midrash Toldot Moshe Rabbeinu, the Midrash, the Life of Moses, right? Which no one quite knows where it's from, when it was written. Most of the commentaries reject it entirely because they don't know where it comes from, but Rashbam, Rishmuel Bar Meir, who is one of the sort of classic literalists, actually accepts it as the simple understanding of Moshe's life.
I thought that Kushit is from Kush.
It's from Kush, right? So this tradition, correct. So this tradition says, yeah, Isha Kushit means
Isha
from Kush, a woman from Ethiopia, right? And then suddenly, right? Now, what would you do if you have a bunch of narrative gaps, right, and a lot of questions? What's the best way to answer them? Find an answer that answers all of them together, right? So what does this midrashic tradition do? This midrashic tradition says, wait, here, let's play some games here, okay? Moshe, we don't know what happens to him, basically from when he's 3 months old to when he's 80. We have like two data points, right? We know that at some point, maybe when he's 20, maybe when he's 40, he confronts the Egyptian. And we know that at some point he marries Tzipporah. And then he gets back to Egypt. Now, when did he marry Tzipporah? At the beginning or the end of this whole story. When do you imagine it? So you would say probably the middle. The problem with that is that on his way to Egypt, his second son is born, and he circumcises. There's a whole story where Tzipporah circumcises his second son on his way to Egypt. But that means if he's having young kids on his way to Egypt, the simplest understanding is that he gets married. Right, we don't get any, not right by Moshe, unlike the patriarchs and the matriarchs, we don't have a story that he suffered infertility for 50 years and then he prayed and God granted him a son. He just has two kids. But if his kids are getting circumcised, and it's not even clear if it's a second son, it might actually be his first son, it's not clear, on his way to Egypt, then that would lead you to believe that when did he get married? When he was old. Right, when he's 80, right before he goes back, when he's 75. So then the Midrash is in even a more complicated situation, which is, wait a second. We don't know what happens to him for a long time. But it's even worse, because I thought I knew that at least in part of that time he got married to Tzipporah. But if he has young kids when he gets back to Egypt, that means he got married when he's 75. So now I got, I don't know, from when he's 20 to when he's 75, that he's neither in Egypt nor is he in Midian. So then this Midrashic tradition said, well, where could he be? So there's only one clue that they have left, which is, oh, he married a woman in Ethiopia. When did that happen? And the Midrash says, I know, in the middle. In the middle, there's a whole story you've never heard of. And this Midrash told out Moshe Rabbeinu and Josephus and Philo record different versions of this tradition which try to answer literally every question we've asked. All the narrative questions we've just said, plus the question of who is Moshe? So here's what you get in Josephus. Okay? This is Josephus, number 14. Josephus Antiquities. And watch how this Midrashic tradition, right? I'm calling Josephus a Midrash because it's doing the same thing, right? It's filling in gaps. It's not part of the rabbinic midrashim, but versions of this midrash appear in midrashim as well. It's just, there are different versions floating around in early rabbinic sources, right? Josephus is just an early Jewish source. He's not a rabbi, but he's, you know, he's grew up amongst the rabbis. His traditions are similar, right? He's recording a lot of things that are floating around in the Jews in that period, in the time of the temple. So that's what he writes. The Ethiopians, who are next neighbors to the Egyptians, made an inroad into their country, which they seized upon and carried off the effects of the Egyptians, who in their rage fought against them and revenged the affronts that they had received from them. But being overcome in battle, some of them were slain, and the rest ran away in a shameful, that should be whatever, they ran away, okay? So the Ethiopians conquered, went in and fought Egypt. Now they proceeded as far as Memphis, and the sea itself, while not one of the cities, was able to oppose them. The Egyptians, under the said oppression, betook themselves to their oracles and prophecies. And when God had given them this counsel to make use of Moses the Hebrew and take his assistance, the king commanded his daughter to produce him, that he might be the general. So the Midrash says, you know what happened? Moses was appointed by Pharaoh to be the general to fight Ethiopia. Anyone recognize this, by the way? What movie does this come in? The Ten Commandments. If you remember when Moses is first brought on the scene, he comes in having conquered Ethiopia, and he brings that woman from Ethiopia who flirts with Moses and gives him jewelry and says, right, we're happy to make peace with Egypt as long as it's through this, you know, that. When Cecil B. DeMille says he drew on Josephus, he's not joking. He got that from Josephus, right? That woman is the Shakushit. That's what he's imagining. That Moses is a general on behalf of the Egyptians, goes and fights Ethiopia, and brings back a woman. Right? That's where it comes from this passage. When he said he drew on Josephus, he's not kidding. It's this passage in Josephus. Right? The Egyptians, under the said oppression, right, okay, sorry, he might be the general of their army, upon which, when she had made him swear that he would do no harm, she delivered him to the king and support those his assistants would. Oh, okay. There should have been an ellipsis there. But of great advantage to them, she with all reproached the priest who, when they had been admonished the Egyptian to kill him, was not ashamed now to own their want of his help. So, where he goes anyways to fight. So what happens? So Moses, at the persuasion both of Thermuthis and the king himself, cheerfully undertook the business. And the sacred scribes of both nations were glad. Those of the Egyptians, they should once overcome their enemies by his valor, and the same piece of management, Moses would be slain. Right? So now, Josephus introduces another tradition. That Ramses does this even though he knows that Moses is a Jew. Right? Because he wants to kill Moses. Right, he wants Moses killed. So he sends him to be a general. Right, so he'll kill two birds with one stone, literally. But those are the Hebrews that they should escape from the Egyptians because Moses was to be their general. But Moses prevented the enemies and took and led his army before those enemies were apprised of his attacking them. When he had therefore proceeded thus on his journey, he came upon the Ethiopians before they expected him. And joining battle with them, he beat them and deprived them of the hopes and that they had of success against the Egyptians, and went on in overthrowing their cities, and indeed made a great slaughter of these Ethiopians. Now, when the Egyptian army had once tasted of this prosperous success by the means of Moses, they did not slacken their diligence insomuch as the Ethiopians were in danger of being reduced to slavery and all sorts of destruction. At length, they retired to Saba, which was a royal city of Ethiopia, which Cambyses afterwards named Mero, after the name of his own sister. However, while Moses was uneasy at the army's lying idle, for the enemy has just not come to battle, this accident happened. Right. So in the middle of this war, this is what Josephus tells you happens. Tharbis was the daughter of the king of the Ethiopians. She happened to see Moses as he led the army near the walls and fought with great courage, and admiring the subtlety of his undertakings and believing him to be the author of the Egyptian success when they had before despaired of recovering their liberty, and to be the occasion of the great danger the Ethiopians were in when they had before boasted of their great achievement, she fell deeply in love with him, and upon the prevalency of that passion sent to him the most faithful of all of her servants to discourse with him about their marriage. He thereupon accepted the offer on condition she would procure the delivering up of the city, and gave her the assurance of an oath to take her to his wife, and that when he had taken possession of the city, he would not break his oath to her. No sooner was the agreement made, but it took effect immediately. And when Moses had cut off the Ethiopians, he gave thanks to God and consummated his marriage and led the Egyptians back to their own land. And you see that this tradition that's floating around in the time of the temple that Josephus records, what does it do? It takes literally every question we've had, both the identity question and the historical question, and tries to answer all of them. And they say, what's going on in all these years? Well, Moses is an Egyptian prince, but Ramses already knows that he's Jewish and therefore suspects that he'll lead a rebellion against him. So he tries to kill two birds with one stone, and he sends him to be the general against Ethiopia. But when he gets to Ethiopia, he's victorious, which cements his status as the prince of Egypt. But while he's fighting Ethiopia, the Ethiopian queen, princess, sees him, falls in love with him, gives up the city to him, and comes back with him to Egypt. So that's how he has an Ethiopian wife. That's what he's doing in all these years, because he's out there running military battles. Right? And his identity is torn. He is an Egyptian general with a history of animosity with Pharaoh, because Pharaoh knows he's Jewish, but the Egyptians view him as their general. Right? And that's what the Ten Commandments took. But you see, this is what Midrash does, is it takes all the questions, the historical questions, the historical gaps, and the identity questions, and weaves a story that answers all of them in one fell swoop. Now, this is one version of it. There's a more, even more fanciful version of it, where Moses is not an Egyptian, is not an Ethiopian, doesn't marry the princess while remaining an Egyptian general, but that he actually moves to Ethiopia and becomes the king of Ethiopia for 40 or 60 years. And that's why he knows how to lead the Jewish people. Because from when he's 75, he's the king of Ethiopia. Then he goes to Midian, marries Tzipora, and then returns having already had experience leading a nation. Right? That's in the Midrash Moshe Rabbeinu, that's the version. Right? He's not an Egyptian general fighting an Ethiopian army, marrying the princes of Ethiopia. He actually moves to Ethiopia and becomes the king of Ethiopia. Right? And then he goes to Midian, so then you got to figure it out, right? God sends him, God ordains it, right? Sort of another accident. And if you read it, you can go online, you can just, you know, you can Google it, and you can see it took hours to read the entire tale, because the Midrashim, especially Midrash Moshe Rabbeinu, tries to construct this story. But this is when you realize this is what Midrash is. This is what Midrash is. It takes gaps, it takes data points, and it tries to answer the questions. Now, the question I haven't addressed is, and it's an important question, is where does the Midrash get the answers to these questions? Now that, there's two very different possibilities. One is that they have a tradition. Right, they have a tradition passed down that they know this is what happened, and they're just recording the stories that were part of the oral tradition. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that, no, they do what we're doing right now. They imagine, and then they construct a story. Now, both of those possibilities have very established history amongst the commentators. The Geonim have very striking lines where they say it's the latter, and they call it hevel pihem. Right? It's the midrashim are just the breath of their mouth, meaning they're great people, and their imagination is as good as anybody else's, and their read of the text is as good as anybody else's. But they say it's not binding because they were imagining what's going on, and that's what all commentaries do. They try to fill in gaps. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle. Right? Probably some midrashim have oral traditions and some don't. Right? I mean, which one is which? I have no idea. So I don't know whether this story is a story that's floating around that Josephus and Philo and Midrash Moshe Rabbeinu just record, or all these texts are responding to the same gaps. But what you see is that when the movies try to fill in the gaps, right? That's exactly what Midrash is doing, right? How they get to those answers, I don't know. But this is what they're doing. Right, is they're taking all the data points, all the value questions, and they're providing a story that answers the questions. What happened here? Now, I want to just throw out quickly, right, an interesting modern attempt, which, to the best of my knowledge, has no midrashic basis, but is actually historically interesting for a different reason. This is from Gods and Kings. So Gods and Kings also imagines Moses as an Egyptian general. But they are very specific. They used history. And they suggest that he's a general in a very important battle, the most important battle in the ancient world for Egypt, of Ramses II, who's probably the pharaoh in the time of the time of the Egyptians, is this one, which is the battle against the Hittites at Kadesh, the Battle of Kadesh. So that's Ramses II over there. And and that's Moses. Later in this scene, Moses actually, in the movie, saves Ramses's life, and it's very interesting and whatever. But what I the reason I think this is interesting, right, is because what we've talked about is sort of midrashic, sort of classical attempts, right? Times from 2,000 years ago, where the rabbis or other Jews, right? I mean, Josephus is a Jew. Again, he's not a rabbi, but he is a Jew living in the time when midrashim are being written. He's engaged in the same type of activity. So they try to imagine or retell stories or tell stories based on what they know of the period. The Gods and Kings actually tries to do the same thing from a modern perspective, because what we know is that the most important battle for Ramses II was this. This is the most celebrated battle in the ancient world. This battle, the Battle of Kadesh. I gave it to you in Wikipedia at the end here, right? That, right, the Battle of Kadesh, or right, took place between the forces of the Egyptian Empire under Ramses II and the Hittite Emperor under Mutwali II at the city of Kadesh on the Oronites River, just upstream of Lake Homs, near the modern Syrian-Lebanese border. It is believed to have been the largest chariot battle ever fought, involving between 5,000 and 6,000 chariots in total. As a result of the multiple Kadesh inscriptions, is the best documented battle in all of ancient history. Right, so this is, right, a big deal. Right, you can see it has this like glorious look to it. Right, it's this huge, massive battle. Why is this interesting? Right, meaning, okay, so Gods and Kings decided that they were going to put Moshe at the Battle of Kadesh. Big deal. The reason it's interesting is, and here's something to chew on, right, is in the new sheet I gave you. So I'm not going to read everything, but I gave it to you so you can read it afterwards. Professor Josh Berman is professor at Bar-Ilan, and he was fascinated by the Battle of Kadesh. He just said, look, the Battle of Kadesh is supposed to have actually taken place in the time of the Exodus. Right? If we have our years right, as I said, the Battle of Kadesh is probably fought by Ramses II, who, to our the best guess of historians, should be the pharaoh that Moses talks to, right? Right. So that's our best historical guess. And as we already saw from the great source of Wikipedia, right, the Battle of Kadesh is the best documented battle in the ancient world, right? This was like Ramses II's pride, that he fought and won. He beat the Hittites at the Battle of Kadesh. But what Professor Berman notes is, if you look at, you see that picture, it's a bit hard to make out, but that picture that I gave you in the middle of the page, that's an ancient inscription which commemorates the Pharaoh's camp during the battle of Kadesh. Right? It's the battle compound of Ramses II. Now, the simplified version of it is on the bottom of the page. You see at the bottom of the page, it says battle compound of Ramses II. Right? Now, look to the right. Right? Right, what's next to it? This is from Josh Berman. Right, the bottom of the page. Right, there's two sort of simplified pictures. The tabernacle. Right, and Professor Berman points out that the Mishkan, right, the tabernacle, seems to have been built. If you to look identical, almost identical, to the compound of Ramses in the Battle of Kadesh. Right, and if you can make it out in the picture, right, if you ever looked at a picture of the Mishkan, where there's sort of an outer courtyard, and then there's a Kodesh and a Kodesh, right, then there's an inner sanctum and a further inner sanctum, and all the way inside is where God speaks, right, all the way inside. Right, you can even see the people bowing if you sort of look carefully, right, and surrounded on the outside is the battle encampment, right. So Professor Berman notes that actually, the descriptions, if you follow them down to the ratios of length to width, is almost identical to the image of the battle encampment at Kadesh and the Mishkan amongst the Jews. Where are the Jews? Right, the Mishkan travels with a battle formation, right, with four camps around it. So Professor Berman has the very far-reaching theory. I gave you the link. But this is, if you want a totally different spin on Passover, this is the place to go. Where he says as follows. A central theme of the Egypt story, he thinks, is what he calls out-pharaohing the pharaoh. Is that God isn't just beating Pharaoh. He's beating Pharaoh by showing him that he can beat him at his own game. And therefore, he notes that if historians are correct, and Pharaoh is Ramses II, at Kadesh, right, the Battle of Kadesh, Pharaoh is described as having beat the Hittites with an outstretched arm, right? There are countless, and he just goes through it. There are different words that are used throughout it that the Torah seems to borrow. I will take you out with an outstretched arm, right? What? Beyad chazaka, exactly. Bizroa nituya. Those words are all, many of those key phrases that we think of in the Exodus are all descriptions of Ramses II at the Battle of Kadesh. And what Professor Berman suggests is that God is actually getting down into the nitty-gritty. To make his point to Pharaoh, he just doesn't beat him. He beats him using his own words and images. Right? You think you have an outstretched arm? Let me show you what an outstretched arm looks like. And then he says the kicker is this. Is that the Mishkan is actually assembled the way the Ramses compound at the Battle of Kadesh. And he says, that's God saying, you think that's greatness? You think the Pharaoh is at the center of the military compound? Is the Godhead in the middle? No, all this glory is mine. Because I'm the God at the center. And the Jews are going to be my battle encampment around my home. Right? You are not the God that has to be contended with. You may be the most powerful force in the ancient world, but I'm the most powerful force in the world. And I'm going to show that to you by recreating your greatest victory against you. Right? So I found it sort of fascinating, right? That in the movie, right, they imagine Ramses and Moses participating in the Battle of Kadesh. But if Professor Berman is right, right, how much more symbolic could it be that Moses and Ramses participate in the Battle of Kadesh, right, and then Moses, who was formerly the general of Egypt, in their most critical battle, is called on by a new general, by a new commander, by a new king to be his general against Ramses. Right? If the movie is correct, right, if Professor Berman is correct, there can be no greater irony, there can be no greater education that God does than by taking not just the Prince of Egypt, but the victorious general in the most important battle in the entire ancient world, and saying, I'm going to steal that general and I'm going to appoint him as mine. He's going to be my general. He's going to be answerable to me as king, and his people are going to be my army. Right? There can be no greater response to the Pharaoh than that. So I thought from a historical perspective, right, if this is true, right, that Moses fought in the Battle of Kadesh, right, and Professor Berman is right, that puts a totally new spin. It's not just that God took the prince of Egypt or the general of Egypt to fight Pharaoh. It's more than that. He takes the general of Egypt who fought in the greatest of all battles, from which Pharaoh, from which Ramses II, right, gets all his glory and says, that's who I want as my general for my people in my kingdom. Right? That is, right, the greatest irony that God could do, which is going to bring us to what we do next week, which is the plagues, which is what is God trying to do in the plagues? Is he just trying to beat them, or is he trying to prove that he's the God above the pantheon? Right? And that's what we're going to do next week. But so what I wanted to do, just to sum up today, is to point out that what the movies are doing and the Midrashim are doing, and what we have to do in the story, is realize there's all these gaps, narrative-wise, right? Where was Moses for all those years? Did he know he was Jewish in the palace? Right? Who's his Cushite wife? All these narrative gaps. Then there's the identity question, which is, who is Moses? Does he identify as an Egyptian, as a Jew? What does that mean for the story? That we have to ask ourselves. The movies try to answer it, the Midrashim try to answer it, but how you imagine it really affects how we view the story. Right? Is Moshe being raised as a Jew in the palace, as an iconoclast, or is he being raised as an Egyptian who will have to struggle with his identity through the process so that the Jews see what it's like to struggle and eventually assert, no, I'm a Jew, not an Egyptian. Right? What is the Pharaoh's relationship to Moses? Do they grow up as antagonists, or do they grow up as brothers? Is Moshe, right, does God want somebody there who's going to identify with the pain of the Egyptians because he's in between identities? Is part of the drama and part of the reason it's so hard for Pharaoh to let them go because he views this as his little brother, someone who grew up in the palace? Is that part of the drama? Is that how God hardens his heart? By sending someone who he sees as his little brother, where he sees this as betrayal. Right? Is there a whole story where Moses isn't just part of Egypt, he's part of Ethiopia? Right? Did Moses fight in the greatest battle? Is God picking him to be his general specifically because he was the general of Egypt? Maybe even in the Battle of Kadesh, maybe in that battle that gave Pharaoh his confidence. Is God trying to undermine his confidence by pulling his general from his greatest battle? Right? All those stories affect how we do the story, but what's clear is that the Torah goes out of its way to not tell you the answer to any of those questions. Because, and this is the last thing I'll leave you with, is I think the reason that even if, let's say, it's oral stories that are passed down, why aren't they written in the Torah? I think because, as we're doing now, it forces you to engage them yourself. It forces you to, right, when you're forced to imagine what it looks like, you're forced to ask the question to yourself, you become engaged, you become emotionally invested. If it spoon-feeds everything to you, that's not what happens. But if they leave the gaps and they force you to realize the questions and try to figure it out for yourselves and fill in the gaps with different stories and different midrashim and different traditions, right? You're forced to imagine and feel what that story was about. And that's really what the Seder night's about, right? Is about not just, as we say, right, is seeing ourselves as if we were in Egypt. But part of that is using our imagination, is imagining what it was like. What are the struggles we would have faced? What are the struggles they faced? How do we identify with those? So those are my thoughts on this. As I said, a bit more speculative, but I think it raises some important questions that we can struggle with as we head towards the Seder.